we realized that, holy shit, this component and the software that's written for it doesn't actually work in all the situations it needs to work. I told the chairman of New Space India Limited that, hey, sadly, we won't be able to launch. On the Sunday when the launch was supposed to happen, I wake up and I'm seeing the launch and I'm like, holy shit, we were supposed to be on there.
Welcome to Backstage with Millionaires, the show where we bring you the stories of real Indian startups told by the entrepreneurs that built them. I'm Caleb Friesen, and on the show today, how Owais Ahmed turned his love for the cosmos into a space tech startup generating millions of dollars in revenue called Pixel. Most of us use satellite data on a daily basis. The imagery that we see on Google Maps, for example, is collected by drones, planes, and satellites up in space, and as consumers, we're able to gain access to these images for free. But if you're a company and you want to get more data-rich imagery of a particular piece of the Earth, then things are going to be a little bit more complicated. Let's say, for example, that you're a farmer or an agriculture business, and you don't just want to see RGB images of your crops, but you actually want to analyze the nutrient and moisture content of the soil across your entire farm, and the chlorophyll content of the leaves on your plants. Well, you can't use Google Maps for this, so what other options are there? The answer is that before Pixel, not many. Governments and militaries around the world were collecting hyperspectral imagery before Pixel came along, but this data was private. It wasn't being sold commercially. And the businesses that were offering satellite imagery as a service were only selling multi-spectral data, imagery across 10 to 20 bands, mainly visible and infrared wavelengths. But there was nobody in the world selling hyperspectral imagery, making upwards of 300 wavelengths commercially available to businesses and governments around the world. And that's the opportunity that Owais Ahmed, one of the founders of Pixel, decided to build his startup around. Owais spent his childhood on the outskirts of Chikmagaluru in Karnataka. Growing up, he would spend hours reading encyclopedia entries and books about space, with the goal of becoming an astronaut when he grew up. Eventually, he was accepted into BITS Pilani, and it was here that he and a fellow BITSian decided to participate in SpaceX's Hyperloop competition, designing a pod vehicle that could be used to transport passengers through hyper tubes. This project became a collaborative effort between Owais and 30 other students, who all ended up spending 3 months in Bengaluru manufacturing this pod.
1 month before we were supposed to actually ship out the pod, we didn't think that we would be able to get it done in time. But the last 2-3 weeks were crazy in the sense that we were living and sleeping and breathing at the workshop where the manufacturing was happening. And that was in Peenya, which is, you know, quite some way away from the city. We were paying for it all on our own. And I remember at the end of it, once we had shipped out the pod, and I was coming back to the paying guest that I was living at, and I'd called my parents then because I hadn't seen them in some time before flying out to the US. And they looked at me and they were like, where did this vagabond come from? Because I hadn't showered for like a week and we were just living there and sleeping there. So fun times. I think everyone has to have that experience to be able to learn how a bunch of people that are just passionate about it come together with zero experience before knowing how to do that.
Wow. Yeah, it sounds like a 3 month long hardware hackathon. Limited sleep, probably poor diet, and lots of fun.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It culminated with you going to the US and actually visiting, what, SpaceX's facility?
Yeah, and it was not easy. So we didn't build all of it in India, right? So we built different components. We built the structure, we built the chassis, we had the carbon fiber separately, we had the electronics and avionics, put some sort of a structure. But there were still about 4 or 5 major components that hadn't been integrated into a Hyperloop pod. And so we shipped them out separately because we had to make it to the US in time. 2 weeks before the competition was supposed to happen, we figured out this. We went to this place called Gearhead's Workshop, which was about 15 minutes from the SpaceX headquarters where the competition was supposed to happen. And it's there that we are figuring out how to integrate it. So a lot of engineering actually happened in LA as well. 90% of us had gone out of the country for the first time, right? And it was my first time going out there as well, living there and being able to perform the thing that we did. And we did some crazy stuff. We actually welded metal onto carbon fiber. I don't think, you know, anyone would have sort of done that, but we were just trying to put this together. There were some components that were supposed to arrive on time that didn't because of customs issues. So we were, shipping magnets. And these magnets are really strong magnets. And they're considered hazardous material, so you need to be able to shield them on flights, and they need special permission. And Cathay Pacific decided to leave the documentation of that in Hong Kong, whereas the magnets came to Los Angeles. And me, a lanky, thin 19-year-old at that point in time, is at the Los Angeles Customs Office, and the officers are looking at me with suspicion, and I'm trying to explain to them that we need these magnets.
Hopefully you had showered by this point.
Yes. Yes. But it caused a delay of a week and a half for us to actually get those magnets, because we had to trace down where did the documents actually end up at. And thankfully, we, you know, after all of that, we managed to get the pod in a working shape, and we transported it to the SpaceX, the road behind beside SpaceX headquarters called, I think, Rocket Road. And it was like a two-day carnival or extravaganza. There were food trucks, and there were Tesla cars, which you could just sort of, you know, go in and sit. You couldn't drive them, but you could just go in and sit. There were rocket engines that were kept aside. So it was very fun. I think it was all worth it at that point in time. So it was not that we finished things in Bangalore and it all went smoothly. It was till the last moment we were just figuring out how to make it work. But it all came together at the end.
Wow. And for you, being there at SpaceX and the way that you grew up, right, I think you sort of self-educated a lot of the time, reading encyclopedias. Eventually, I think in the eighth standard, you got a computer and were able to do your own research online. I remember in one interview, you talked about how you had tried to convince your dad to buy a telescope, and you know your family wasn't off enough to buy one.
Yeah.
So now you're here, like you're at SpaceX, and I think they even gave you a tour, right? They showed you around the facilities.
I think technically I wasn't supposed to go into all the areas because of ITAR constraints, but there were just so many students that they took all the teams in. They gave us free ice cream at the cafeteria as well, but it was the real desert was looking at those rocket engines being built, and just like, you know, SpaceX was for me at that point like the mecca of my life, to be able to go to a place where so much has been done privately. Going there, looking at those rocket engines being built, and then coming out of the headquarters and seeing the Falcon 9 booster that had for the first time ever landed back on Earth, that proved that reusable rockets could be done. That was the point of no return for me, right? I could just feel the electricity in the place and decided that space is the space for me. And I'm going to go back and I'm going to figure out how to make that happen, which is what led to Pixel. But I think it was like my pilgrimage to a place that that I'd looked forward to for so long.
But this was 2017, right? So
that's right.
Going, being Indian and coming back to India after all of that fanfare, it would have been really exciting, of course, to meet Elon and see the facilities. But I think this was before the space tech industry in India was opened up to private players. So how could you have even conceptualized this idea of getting into that space? Was your idea at that time to just join ISRO, or did you actually want to start something of your own that early on?
I just looked at, okay, NASA, SpaceX, you know, Lockheed, Boeing, a bunch of other companies, and then ISRO on one side. There was no way that I could join NASA or SpaceX or any of the US companies because of ITAR restrictions. There's like a blanket no hiring policy, except if you are really, 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 really smart to be hired there. And then ISRO, I knew a few folks that had sort of gone there, and it just seemed like too bureaucratic in terms of, I respect the work that they do, but I think for a new engineer joining, the amount of time it takes to be able to get to a point where you can actually make contributions is too long. So it didn't seem like something to me. So as I said, that comes back to the point of the being there, the Hyperloop team, looking back and saying, you know, if a bunch of 30 undergraduate students can build a Hyperloop pod, maybe students can build a satellite too. And Planet Labs at that point in time had started making waves in the US. And so we were like, if now companies can start making satellites in garages, there's no reason why students probably can't look at it. There was a little bit of too much confidence coming from the Hyperloop thing, that if you could build a Hyperloop pod in 3 months, we can possibly build a satellite in 3 months too. So that really, I think, took us through. And once we get started, the momentum takes you along. But there was no big plan as to, okay, very specifically, we will create a satellite startup. It was just coming back from there, identifying that NASA, SpaceX are not an option, ISRO is not an option, that only left creating something of our own. The initial plan was exactly like the Hyperloop. We will copy that template where we create a student team at BITS. We will raise sponsorship for that satellite. We will launch it. And on the basis of that, we will create a company. Things changed, of course, after that. But that was how the thought process was.
Interesting. So you say we. At that point, was it you and this idea of getting together a bunch of students, or yeah. was Kshitij?
At that point, it was just me. So coming back from SpaceX, the Hyperloop team sort of went their different ways. Great experience, but then there was a little bit of friction between different folks. And Sibeshkar, who was the person that really came up with the idea of participating there, whose room I stumbled into, which made it all happen for the Hyperloop team. And
yeah, he was like writing stuff down on a whiteboard.
Yeah, exactly. I was visiting his roommate. And he was scribbling things about the Hyperloop. And I'm like, hey, I know about the Hyperloop. And we got to talking. And he's like, he was thinking of participating in the Hyperloop competition. And so I said, I want to join you. And then since he was a senior, I went around putting posters in the in the campus that we're hiring for the Hyperloop team. And then we built the team from there. So right after that, you know, he left because of friction with the other folks. And then the team essentially spread apart after that competition. And so that was the span of about 3 to 4 months between coming back from Hyperloop and talking to Kshitij that I just started looking at all of these options. And then after researching a whole bunch of stuff about what can possibly be done, I decided that asteroid mining is what I want to do in life. That's like the ultimate purpose for me to be able to
really
mine stuff from asteroids and use that as material for expanding humanity into space. Because there's no way we can use materials on Earth and spoil the Earth to be able to build habitats in space. And I'm all for setting up bases on the moon and Mars that Elon and others are trying to do. But those are just stepping stones, because when you look at the solar system, when you look at the galaxy, most of it is empty space. So you need to be creating your own biomes in space if you want to expand beyond the solar system, if you want to expand beyond just our near vicinity. And that can only happen if you have material in space to actually build this. So asteroid mining is still what I want to do as my ultimate goal, maybe 50 years, maybe 30 years down the line. And out of that, when researching about asteroid mining, I came across this technology called hyperspectral imaging, which you will need to be able to identify what is actually present in the asteroid. Is it containing this? Does it consist of this metal or this mineral? Is it stony? Is it carbonaceous? Is it metallic asteroid?
Yeah, NASA uses that technology to even analyze other planets, right?
Exactly.
The composition of
exactly. Their... Yeah. So the JWST spacecraft that went up uses spectroscopy to identify, you know, what the composition of planets might be so far away. We're just using that for the Earth. So the plan was then, and I was a big fan of Elon Musk at that point in time. So he had a master plan for Tesla that he had created and SpaceX that he had created, which was step one, you know, build rockets, generate revenue from that. Step two, build Starlink, generate more revenue from that. Step three, use that money to create a Mars base. So I sort of try to emulate that by saying, okay, step one, use hyperspectral imaging to map the Earth. Step two, use that to map the solar system and the asteroid belt. And step three, use that proprietary information to go out and actually mine stuff, right? And then the idea was very straightforward. So we said, okay, I decided that we will build a constellation of hyperspectral imaging satellites because of my previous experience at Team Anand, which is a student satellite team, also had given some context on how to build satellites. And that idea came together then. And there was also this thing called the XPRIZE that were coming up at that point in time. So the idea very crudely was, we will start with applying for the XPRIZE as AI XPRIZE by saying we will use artificial intelligence on space data, use that money to be able to build a satellite so that we can provide data for that. And all of that didn't obviously happen. I had in my mind that there would be a constellation of about 24 to 30 hyperspectral satellites, and hyperspectral seems to be a technology that no one is building today, no one has built in space today. So I just sent LinkedIn emails and cold emails to about 30 customers across the globe who I could Google that they were already using satellite imagery. And more than 90% of them actually responded and said that they would be willing to pay premium for hyperspectral data. So
these were just like cold emails.
These were just cold emails. And the people were nice enough to be able to respond and say that this is what they're paying existing data to Planet and others, and they would love hyperspectral.
They gave you that information.
They did.
What credentials did you put in front of them to convince them to send you that?
Honestly,
hey,
nothing.
I'm just a student or just graduated.
Yeah. I'm a student at BITS. I'm thinking of doing hyperspectral imaging from space. Can you provide information around what you're paying Planet? What do you use information for? Would you buy hyperspectral data? What would you pay for it? So there was a 5-6 list of questions that I sent everyone, and more than 90% of them actually responded.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's not as hard as people think. Okay. And so you were able to sort of validate your idea using the responses that you got from that email. How confident were you, or I guess what was the timeline that you were imagining at that point? How quickly did you think you'd be able to, because you were imagining 3 months, you know?
Yeah.
And a satellite in a way, as a concept, is not complicated, right? A satellite can be anything that's up in space, yeah. right? You could send a smartphone up into space.
Yeah.
But obviously, you also have to think about how to power that satellite, how to send the data back down to Earth. Is all of those pieces coming together in a form factor that actually functions on a sort of daily or weekly basis, sending information back and forth? The complexity of that, is that why nobody had already gotten into the hyperspectral commercial space?
Yeah, so I think, look, you can, as you said, you can make anything a satellite. And it's a good learning experience for a student to be able to build a 10 centimeter across 10 centimeter across 10 centimeter cube satellite, which anyone can do now, and just as long as you have money, throw it up in space. But does it have actual utility in terms of real world applications? In most cases, it does not, right? It was a great way to teach people and to inspire people that you can actually work on something space, and it made it possible to democratize it in the truest sense, space technology, which is only limited to the governments. But the realization was that building hyperspectral cameras is very complicated. It's complicated for use on Earth, and then it's another level of complicated when you actually need to work from space, which also seemed like, okay, this is a tough technical problem to solve, which makes it a natural advantage if you're able to actually figure out. And a lot of that confidence came from actually being part of the student satellite team, where we were looking at a fairly sophisticated satellite. We were not just, we will put anything together and we will send it up there. We were working with the scientists at ISRO to actually do a very in-depth analysis of a small shoebox size satellite. So it was a small satellite, but the components and the way we were going about it was actually a lot more mature than most CANSATs or student satellites that you would generally see today. But that was still nowhere near the level of complexity we would need to realize a hyperspectral camera, right?
This shoebox size satellite.
Yeah.
This was just like a prototype kind of thing.
Correct, yes. And we don't have shoebox size satellites. Our satellites are much bigger now, right? Because we realized...
How big are they?
About the size of a mini refrigerator you would see in a hotel room.
Okay.
But they weigh a whole lot more. Instead of about 3 kilograms that a shoebox size satellite weighs, our satellite weigh around 50 kilograms, right? So it's significantly more complex and much more dense.
Whereas the shoebox size, how much would that have weighed?
3 to 5 kilograms.
Got it. Okay.
Right. So there's the CubeSat is, you have different units. So 1U is a 10 cross 10 cross 10 centimeter cube, 1 unit. And then when people talk about 3Us and 6Us, it's stacking up of those units in 3 of them or 6 of them or 12 of them. And each of those Us approximately weighs 1 to 1.5 kilograms, right? In our case, we are not building CubeSats. What we said was, these questions I had sent across to the customers, they got back with the resolution and the quality of data that they wanted. So we knew what the customers wanted. We then used that to design our camera around it. We then used that to design the satellite around it. We didn't say that we're going to select the satellite size first, which decides the camera size, which decides the quality. We looked at it the other way around.
That's really smart. Asking the, right? But a lot of entrepreneurs make that mistake of building something first, and then they go to the customer and say, hey, I built something. Do you want it? And the customer's like, no, I want this instead.
Yeah.
You started with the customer, which I think has probably saved you a lot of time and money.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that has been validated again and again as we now start, you know, sharing data with our customers. So once that, all of that was in mind in terms of, okay, from the student satellite team, I knew how to build a satellite roughly. Again, that level of knowledge was nowhere near enough, we realized later. And the confidence from the Hyperloop experience and realizing that, okay, we can build and deploy a constellation and we have first-hand information from potential customers that would be willing to buy our data. That seemed like enough to get started. And while this was all happening, you know, Shidish and I knew each other for about 2.5 years then in college. Due to a variety of different things, we used to play FIFA together. We used to have Maggie together at the campus. And it was one of... Right after one session, he saw something scribbled on the whiteboard, and so we got to talking, and then I was just reading about things on Y Combinator website, and there was this one thing I remember where they said, it's almost always easier to give up 50% of your company to get a co-founder because it saves you hell of a lot of trouble later. And so I said, hey, do you want to, you know, do this together? And he said, yeah, let's do it. And at that point in time, it was still as a student team, so the startup came much later, but you know, thankfully he said yes, and I had someone to sort of start going deeper into it.
Yeah, definitely. Building this shoebox-sized satellite, it's not as big as the satellites that you guys currently have up in space, but I'm sure it wasn't like, it's not, you can't build it for free, right? So how were you able to finance that at an early stage? Was it sort of money out of your pocket? Was it family and friends? Like, tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, yeah. So the initial set of money came from my own savings. So when I was, I think, in eighth grade, my dad started this tradition where he said, if you came first in your tests, you'll get 3,000 rupees. If you came second, 2,000. If you came third, 1,000. If you came fourth, yeah, that's bad. Too bad. So that really motivated me to get first or second, right? And I'd saved up a whole lot of money by the time I got out of 12th. And all of that, my dad ended up putting in a fixed deposit. And at the end of around the third year of college, I'd gone back home and we were having lunch, I remember, 3 p.m. or so. And then he said, the FD is maturing. Do you want to use this? Do you want to use the amount that you have in the fixed deposit to go on a trip somewhere? And I just thought about it for a few seconds and said, I think I have a better use for that. And started the, I think it was about three and a half lakhs, which included gifts that I'd received in festivals as well as the savings that we used to get started on 3D prototype manufacturing, right? We were all still paying for our own travel to Delhi and wherever we need to go. But all of that essentially went towards the first of 3D manufacturing something where we could spend 50,000, 60,000 rupees on each iteration.
And that's how much it costs for the raw material.
For each,
the 3D printing, what's it called? The substrate or
ABS.
Like, ABS.
Yeah. ABS is the material that's used. But yeah, for all the material that you need to be able to pay who has the 3D printer for their time and everything else. So we ended up creating about three different iterations of CubeSat at that point in time because, you know, we were just starting off and we needed to do something small. But none of that was in any shape or form close to flying. We just wanted to be able to test something and iterate something. And 3.5 is not a whole lot of money when you're trying to look at satellites and 3D printing. So we quickly ran out of that. I kept going back to my dad at regular points of time to get more money for paying for the travel of some other students that had decided to join us, thankfully, right? In the summer after the Hyperloop, we asked about 10 other folks in the university to join us on their own dime because we didn't have any money at that point. We were using all of that for prototyping. And thankfully, there were people that had enough trust and faith or just enough interest in building a small satellite that they came there and we got to it. So that helped save a lot of money, but we couldn't ask them to spend on travel that was needed and everything else. So I kept going essentially back to my dad to ask money. And I think overall, I borrowed an additional 8 to 10 lakhs from him across the course of a few months. And I'm pretty sure at some point he got worried as to where it is going. But he never said no, right? He always knew that this was something that we were trying to do as a student team. So thankful for that. That's where the initial set of money came from. But what that did was, given that we had something actually physical now in terms of prototyping, we used to show that to some investors that we started talking to that really made us feel like we were legit and not really just, you know, thinking about it on paper.
Sure. But at that point, you're talking to investors, or was this still the days of like, you're going out to Samsung and like some other companies to see if they're willing to sponsor it for?
Yeah, let me talk about that sequence. So we decided in the summer of 2018. So summer of 2017 was all for Hyperloop, and then August, September was in SpaceX. And then I came to college, and then we spent a few months, thinking about it. And then Shithi joined around a few months after that. And after that, in April, before exams, we brought on board about 8 more people. So that was like a 10-member team. And then we moved to Bangalore in May, right after the exams again. So this was summer of 2018. And at that point in time, the plan was to raise sponsorship. So at that point, we started thinking of all possible options. We went back to the same people that had sponsored the Hyperloop pod, and most of them had not seen any return of interest. So they said, no, that's fine. Some people who had helped us manufacture the structure and manufacture the electronics for Hyperloop were willing to also look at doing it at a discount, but not for free anymore. So there was obviously some level of network that was there thanks to Hyperloop, but then we needed to raise about 3 crores, 3.5 crores, we realized, to actually build a 3U CubeSat at that point in time. And then we ended up increasing the size of the satellite. But when we were starting, we were like, okay, we'll build a 3U CubeSat. We need about 3, 3.5 crores to be able to do that. And the idea for that was to go to 1 or 2 smartphone companies and get 1 crore each to get us started. So we tried reaching out to the OnePlus executives and Samsung executives and a few other folks to say, we're going to put your phone on the 3U satellite. We're going to take an image of the money shot, which you can use to advertise that your phone went to space. No one really bit anything that we were saying. And I think a couple of months down the line after we were there in the summer of 2018 is when someone who we were working with, so we were working at a makerspace right under the Hulsoor metro station in Bangalore. And the person at the makerspace said, I think you should probably start talking to angel investors and investors that he was connected to. And so we got talking to investors then. So that was really when the pivot happened. And during that summer is also when we decided that, okay, might be that the student satellite approach is not the best. We would probably need to create a company to start going and talking to investors. So that's when the transition happened from a student team to actually saying, okay, we'll do it as a startup.
There was some, I don't know when in this story this happened, but there was some former sort of senior person at ISRO, probably retired, and he had basically told you guys that this is impossible. Like you're not going to succeed.
Yeah.
Was that around this time or did that happen earlier on?
This happened just before we got the Techstars investment.
Oh, wow.
So we were looking at getting incubated at the Indian Institute of Science to get some grant money that they would provide to companies that they incubated. We ended up going the Techstars route because we didn't want to be part of two incubators, two accelerators. So that didn't happen. And the IIC folks were great, right? Love the folks, and it's a great institution. But they had brought on board someone who had been at ISRO for an insane amount of time, and massive respect to the amount of work that is done. But I think it just motivated us a hell of a lot more. So I remember things are getting feisty at the discussion table where this person is saying that what you are talking about at the cost and at the satellite size, it's impossible for you to build what you are saying that you will build. And we are like, no, it's not, because the physics talks here. We know how the sensor looks like. We know how the optics look like. We just need money to be able to go out and put it up there. So, and he said he has been working in the space industry for longer than the both of us have been alive, which was true. We were 20, 21, 21 each, so 42. And he probably had 45 years of experience at ISRO. And when someone says that, obviously it's very deflating for you because you are, swimming against the tide, and someone who's supposed to be encouraging you says that it's impossible and you'll never be able to get there. But I think at the end of it, Shirish and I, looked at each other and we said, you know what, we just need to prove these people wrong. IAC actually, even after that, came back and said that we'd be happy to put in a little bit amount of money, maybe just because we were able to respond back and hold our own in the discussion, which might have counted for something. But yeah, that was not the first time where we have been told that this is not going to be possible. People didn't take us seriously because we were students. They were thinking that we were just doing this as a student project, whether we were even serious about it, whether we'll be able to raise a new amount of money. Lots of people didn't end up investing in us at the pre-seed because they thought we will never be able to raise another round of money and things like that. But anyway, I think that specifically stood out in my mind, because when someone who has so much amount of experience says something is impossible, then you need to definitely go deeper into that and see, how that can be made possible. Sometimes unless it's physically impossible to do that, unless the laws of physics prevent it, something should definitely be possible. So, yeah.
Ah, well, it's that mentality that's kept a lot of people away from the space, right? So it was wide open for you guys.
Yeah.
I think you had reached out to a couple of BITS alums. You had also reached out to, was it people at...
Not that point in time, right? Oh. So this was we were just about starting sponsorship, and then we started talking to one or two investors in Bangalore, and they strung us along for quite a long time. And
just like local angels?
Yeah, local angels and some micro VCs. I'm not going to take names, but
no worries.
There were a few that decided that they wanted to learn as much as possible about this space, but I don't think they ever intended to invest, right? So we kept creating more and more documentation and more research, and we kept sending for about 4 months, and nothing materialized. At some point, we realized this is not going to happen. But during the course of those 4 months also is when we started reaching out to some angels from the BITSIAN community about the later half of that period of time. And there was this one event that we came across called BITSYNC.
Was that the one in Silicon Valley?
In Silicon Valley, exactly. So there was a startup pitch event that was being advertised, call for startups to present to the who's who of BITS alumni. And there was no more money at that point. I had already spent all of my savings. I'd already spent all of the money that I had borrowed from my dad.
Dad cut you off?
No, he didn't. I didn't really want to go back to him for more. We don't come from a very well-off family. So I just didn't want to be able to go back and ask for more, because at that point in time, like, we raise sponsorship, we raise investment or nothing. Thankfully, we were working with this BITSIAN who had graduated a few years ago at a mapping company, who we were trying to work with something where we said, we will build satellites for you to map the country. That didn't materialize from a company standpoint, but he was personally interested in this. So he ended up putting 10 lakh rupees, right? So which was a very, very small amount, like it's pre-seed. And the reason for that was four days from the day we are talking about, there is the BITSYNC event in Silicon Valley. And 4 days before, they sent us an email saying, you've been selected as one of the startups to pitch there. And we didn't have any money. I called him up and said, hey, we need money to be able to go here. Can you help us out in any sense? Can the company pay for our travel? Because it might help you later. And he said, the company is not possible, but I'll personally put in some amount of investment. And so I did a crash course on, you know, the valuations and investment through the YC website and YouTube, and went back to him the next day and said, okay, you can put it in at a small percentage amount. We'll be looking at raising a larger pre-seed. And thankfully, he didn't fight back on that too much. And he wired the money. And he couldn't wire the money, obviously, because it required documentation for the startup and et cetera. But what he did was he directly booked the flight from his own money 2 days before the event from Delhi, which was a few hours from Pilani where I was, and to San Francisco. And I reached out to local Bitsians who were in the Silicon Valley to stay. So the entire trip was paid for by this angel in literal sense who had graduated from Bits a few years ago in the mapping company, and thanks to the people that were willing to let me stay there.
You did couch surfing in
SF? Yeah, couch surfing, exactly. I stayed with two folks across a week, and I had to pay zero money for travel, and just spend the lunch and other stuff on my own, which was something that was fine, good compromise. And then ended up flying to Silicon Valley a couple of days. That was my first time in San Francisco and the surrounding Bay Area. And I had reached out, again, through cold emails to a few folks that were well-known as people who had made it, who had hundreds of millions of dollars, who would be willing to possibly, you know, invest something. And
Bitsians?
All Bitsians. Like, there was no one outside. It was all Bitsians, thanks to the network and people willing to help. And the BitSync event actually went really well. It was a way of pitching to multiple people in the same room. And apart from that, also, I set up about 3 or 4 meetings. And it was those 3 or 4 meetings that really, two of those folks that I had met decided that this might seem like a worthwhile philanthropic investment for them at that point. It was like someone from Bits is trying to do something cool. $25, $50, $100,000 for them was not too much money. So they're like, if it works, it works. If it doesn't, that's fine. And that is really what got the momentum started to close the round. So that is that was the first investment thing happened. I think this was October of 2018.
Were you able to raise the entire, you said three?
This was October 2018. And then that was just when people started getting interested, and then came back to college in November and December to spend just sending them a little bit more information. And that round extended all the way till June of 2019. So October of 2018 was the event. We finally ended up getting about $500,000, which was about 3.5 crores at that point, thanks to angel investors. So I think it took that much amount of time for us to get it all together. And that was also because $120,000 out of that came from the Techstars accelerator, which we had applied for. And this was a Techstars space-focused accelerator, and so we got selected. So $120,000 from them, and then all the other angel investors ended up becoming exactly 500K. And then we had GrowX that came on board in April, that extended that by 200K. So we had a 700K total pre-seed round, which exceeded what we wanted to raise. Now we could afford to pay a little bit of salary for the people that we could hire as well, apart from just the bill of material cost.
That's kind of important too, yeah, paying salaries.
Yeah.
Wow, what a journey getting to that point where finally you have a bunch of, at that time it would have felt like a bunch of money in the bank.
More money than any of it seen in life.
Oh yeah, of course. Because up until this point, it had been your dad basically helping you out. Yeah. And you're planning to build this this satellite now, the first proper satellite. Is the plan to send that into space?
Yes.
Okay. And you did end up sending it into space, or
this
or
was Anand. So the first satellite we started building was Anand, and it was the third of the demo satellites that went up. So the last of the demos we built. So there's a big story around that as well. But what we had done was we had partnered with a company that had offices in Bangalore and Chennai who had manufactured some components for ISRO. So we said we will partner with them to realize a satellite together where they would build some of the same components that they have provided to ISRO. And then, you know, our team will sort of put together the camera, put together the rest of the things and make it a satellite. And so since we didn't have any infrastructure whatsoever, we decided we would go to their office in Chennai and we would, you know, get it done there. So the four of us, me and Shitich, and the first two founding engineers, Manas and Teja, all from Bits, same year, decided to move in the last 6 months of our college. A couple of us were doing our six-month thesis, and a couple of them were employed in practice school, so the six-month internship at that point in time. So we figured out a way of being in Chennai while still being in college. And we were thrown out of that office in March of 2019 because we had signed a contract with them that we would pay them something for the components as well as for using space in their office. But as I just told you, the investment didn't come across until like April, May, June of 2019. And so we kept on telling them from January of 2019 that we would pay you. In March, they were like, yeah, you need to get out until you get the money. But that's where, thankfully, I think, you know, partnering with someone who wasn't necessarily the best in the world at doing that. We could have found much better components, much better quality, but at least we had someone who had done something similar for ISRO. So that really got us started. And then our team just got better at just assimilating information from the internet, talking to folks from ISRO. So the plan was always that we would work with this Chennai-based company to manufacture this micro satellite. And we would end up, we would launch it by the end of 2019. And then that changed. We would launch it by the end of 2020. And then we booked the launch with a Russian Soyuz rocket for Feb of 2021. That got moved to PSLV after things changed. And then finally, it ended up going in November of 2022. But yes, that was the first satellite that was always planned to be sent to space. Now, the crazy thing about it is when someone builds a satellite, they first build an engineering model, and then they build a qualification model, and then they build a flight model. Essentially, you are testing something to prove that it works, and then you are qualifying it by testing it, and then you are launching something. In our case, we just said, we don't have money to do all of this. We're just going to build a flight model. If it works, it works.
That might be part of the ISRO DNA too, right? The fact that you had sort of worked with people at ISRO. What I've heard is that they tend to do things on a scrappier budget as well, right?
They do, but we were way more scrappier than that as well.
Yeah.
I think the good thing about them that they do in a scrappy budget means that their vendors who we work with now as well are much cheaper than what it would be if we were to go elsewhere outside of the country to procure those components. So that's been helpful from that standpoint. But having these scientists from ISRO who could tell us at least that where we were going wrong and what are the pitfalls that we need to be careful of, that you need to make sure your satellite does this on ground before you send it to space, was actually really helpful.
Yeah. So something that's really interesting about your business, and I think a lot of space tech businesses as well, is that you can't just sort of build something like an MVP and try to sell it to the customer and see what they think. You get input from them, you sort of iterate, and then you sort of upgrade the models until eventually you get to the first proper product that you can sort of take to market. With you guys, your product is this hyperspectral data and probably the processing that goes into that, the form factor that ends up reaching the final customer. There's all these different sort of wavelengths of data that you're collecting, and then you're able to sort of present that to the end customer for their specific use case, right? Maybe they're doing mining, maybe they're in agriculture, you know, anything, right? It could be pollution, you're, you know, potentially working with governments to provide this data.
Yeah.
You guys couldn't really do that, right? You couldn't start selling this information because you didn't have any satellites in space to even collect that information.
Yeah.
So were there any things that you guys did? Like, was it basically like you guys started making revenue from 2022? Or were there other revenue generating activities that you were able to do even earlier than that?
Yeah, no, zero. We started generating revenue in 2022.
Wow.
We started generating revenue, I think, by doing satellite imagery analytics. Not on our own data, but with other data set, too, because you know we wanted to see how that was. And the plan was to eventually replace that external data set with our own hyperspectral data. But really, the significant amounts of revenue for our own data started just last year in 2022. Before that, you just have to be a little, you just have to trust your gut that this is a resolution that works for the customers, because everyone has a wish list of they want data daily, and they want it hourly, and they want it at submeter resolution, and they want hundreds of bands. So you can't really trust all of that. You need to be able to assimilate that information and then take a gut call that you think that this is the way that it needs to be. Sort of, you still need to listen to your customer. So what we have done is, out of the three demos that we have launched, we have successfully made the resolution better, but we've also taken feedback around other quality parameters and used that to build the commercial satellites that we're building. So there's still aspects of that involved, like in any other startup. You have to listen to your customer. You have to make sure that the quality of the data will be something that they will be happy with. Then build the camera around it, then build the satellite around it. But you don't have the same level of feedback loop that a software company would have, where you can easily change something, because once you launch something to space, it doesn't change. But yeah, you just have to have a thesis and hope that the thesis turns out well, sort of like the iPhone, where they didn't know if the touchscreen was going to catch on and things like that. But if you build a good product, I think that will have value. It will figure itself on its own. That's what we try to have a thesis around.
Yeah. So it sort of puts you in a position where you're not making money from any kind of revenue. So you do have to continue to dilute, right? Yeah. You have to sort of go out, raise funding from, from VC firms, from investors, which is, you know, that's not uncommon, right? Everyone's doing that. And sorry, I think I should probably just briefly break down like RGB, multispectral, and hyperspectral for people who are watching. RGB is like the kind of image that you get from a camera, red, green, and blue, and you sort of combine those all together into a pretty picture. Multispectral would be sort of outside of that human eyesight range where you're collecting other types of wavelengths like infrared, but it's not like the full, you know, spectrum of all the different wavelengths. And then hyperspectral is like what, like more than 100-150 wavelengths. I think you guys are collecting, is it like in the ballpark of 300 wavelengths?
300, or?
Which is significantly more useful for people, because you can see stuff that the human eye can't see. It's not something that's been provided commercially, at least not on the scale that you guys are doing now with Pixel. But it's also significantly more difficult to collect that information and beam it back down to Earth, because I think probably one, this is just my guess, but like, first of all, the power required to even take those snapshots, I'm not even sure how frequently you take them, but that's 300 wavelengths in a single go, which consumes more more power, right? So you have to collect that power. I'm guessing solar from the sun. You've got
that's right, solar panels.
Solar panels on the satellite itself, and then you need enough power to also send that stuff back down to Earth, and that's quite a bit of data. These are how many? Is there like a real like a file size that people can sort of understand how large a 300 wavelength image, or I don't know, you call it an image? Is that what it is?
It's an image, yeah. So I think what we take a continuous stream of data. So as the
almost like a video.
It's not a video because we are not capturing the same area. Like a video is a playback of images of the same area. In this case, a satellite is moving across the Earth at different places, and we're just keeping the camera on. It's like opening
the sensor is just recording ones and zeros.
It's recording. So you're taking like a long swath, like a thin strip of image, as long as you want to keep it open. There's obviously constraints around how long you can keep the camera open thermally and otherwise, but
you would keep it open for a specific customer?
Yeah, so the plan is to keep it open for as long as possible and then cut the images and sell different images to different customers. But we generally look at it as one image. We think of it as a 20 kilometer cross 20 kilometer image. That would be in the... Each image would be you know, in the tens of GBs range.
Got it.
Okay. And then when you're taking a continuous snap of it, we will be beaming down 2 terabytes per satellite per day, and then there'll be 6 satellites of these, and it quickly adds up to, you know, multiple petabytes over a month, and then so on and so forth. Yeah.
So it's, and like as a photographer myself, like, you know, it's hard to deal with these kinds of file sizes, right? It's not, I mean, we have like multiple terabytes of storage in our office. You can buy these on Amazon. You guys presumably would be sending it to AWS for storage.
So the challenge is on ground. You have large chunks of hard drives that you can use, SSDs. You generally use SSDs in space because they get corrupted very quickly unless you've shielded them a whole lot.
Is that because of like radiation in space?
Yeah, solar flare radiation, cosmic radiation, and just Earth's magnetic. So there are these Van Allen belts where there's a lot of, you know, weird stuff happening. So you don't have a lot of storage on the satellite. You probably have, you know, 500 GBs. In our case, 128 GBs is what we started with, and we will have about 2 terabytes. That gets quickly exhausted in just a few seconds of imaging. Then that means that in the same orbit, you have to beam all of that down very quickly, and the stronger your radio is, the more power consuming thing it is. So it all successively adds up essentially. So yeah, you're right in terms of the fact that if you have 300 wavelengths of information coming in hyperspectral data compared to 8 wavelengths of multispectral data, it's literally that many times of data that's coming down.
Yeah. And so all of this adds up to a picture where you're going to need a lot of money, right? To make this happen.
A lot of money.
It's not like, it's not like a D2C company that can just start anytime they want. So you're going out to investors now. You've got 700K in the bank. Obviously, you're going to need much more than that to actually make this happen and to send up the number of satellites that you need to form a constellation around the Earth. I think you've compared it to like a health monitor for the planet, right? Where you're just constantly monitoring planet Earth, which I think is a beautiful analogy. And then the pandemic hits.
Yeah.
So I think you guys were out there raising this seed round.
Yeah.
And then COVID happens.
Yeah.
Like, Tell me about that moment in time.
Yeah, so we finished Techstars Accelerator in September, and then, you know, at the end of Techstars, at the end of any accelerator like YC or Techstars is a demo day. And so we had the demo day in September, as far as I recall, yes. And then we started putting a round together, or at least started going out to investors saying that we need to raise now a few million dollars. We started with wanting to raise $3.5 million, because that's what we thought will enable us to build one more demo satellite, will enable us to finish the first satellite that we started building and launch it as well. And then it took an insane amount of time to talk to 100, 120, 150 investors. I don't really recall the exact amount, but a lot of them said no, essentially. They were all willing to take meetings because, oh, a bunch of 21-year-olds are building satellites. Very cool. Let's at least talk to them and see what's happening. So I think it was easier to get into a room, but then to be able to convince them to take a bet on something like this was an entirely different matter. And so we spent a whole lot of time, inordinate amount of time in October, November, December, and Jan, just talking to as many people as possible to get them to commit to us. Thankfully, GrowX, who had come in the pre-seed round, had already said that they would end up participating in the seed round if it came together. And so we had a little bit of momentum there. In February, finally, we came to a point where we had $3 million worth of commitments from different angel investors and from a couple of funds. And that was also due to the fact that we had this person called Ryan Johnson, who had built and operated his own company in Canada, who we got connected to through a mutual connection, who came down to our demo day and had breakfast with us, and for some inexplicable reason decided to say he's going to put a significant chunk of his own money in our company, which gave a lot of validation for us, which I think without which it would almost have been almost impossible to raise any money. But, you know, once that happened and, you know, we could build it around not only a person who was putting in a decent amount of money, but also the fact that he had built and operated his own constellation of satellites and was acquired by Planet Labs, one of the few exits in the space technology industry, that helped put that together. But then, as you said, in March, things went to shit. The COVID hit and lockdown started. And then this investor got cold feet. And so the entire round fell apart, because no one will put money unless you have the entire money to get to the next milestone. And without that investor, we didn't have the money to get to the next milestones. And I am now in Chikmagalur in Aldur at my hometown because lockdown. I thought it would be like a week worth of stay and I would be back. That turned out to be wrong by magnitudes. But anyway, so I'm in Aldur. Shitesh has gone back to Maharashtra where he's at. Everyone's gone back home. We can't go to the offices because it's complete lockdown. We can't manufacture the satellite. So that stopped. And we have no money in the bank. We had like probably a couple of months of money left out of the 700K. Out of the 700K, we had spent 500K on the satellite itself. The rest of it had been on travel, on salaries and things like that. So very, very lean at that point in time. We were only about 7 people at that point. 4 of us were students and the others had families and things like that. So there's a little bit of pressure then that now you can't let you know, their family's responsibility is now your responsibility. And so thankfully, we had talked to Bloom and Lightspeed in person before and they had already said no to this round. But we then reached back out to them again and said, hey, you know, we are trying to put this round together. Do you want to come back in? And for some, again, inexplicable reason, we ended up having four or five conversations with them, with their larger team. And in COVID, without them seeing any hardware for a hardware company, they decided that they would both come in and invest. The idea was one of them would probably say yes and we would survive. But both of them thankfully came in and said, okay, we will invest. Now that $3.5 million ended up becoming $5 million thanks to both Lightspeed, Bloom, and then GrowX being there and Ryan Johnson being there. And then the process of actually signing the documentation, negotiating the documentation with 3 different potential lead investors started. So we had run out of money by then, but thankfully we had a term sheet at least. So we went to the same folks, the angel investors like Ryan and others, and said, hey, why don't you loan us the money that you said you were going to invest? Because, you know, that money will probably come in, right? We just need to dot the I's and slash the T's. And thankfully, a few people decided to loan us enough money for the next 3 months for us to pay other salaries. We didn't take salaries. In August of 2020, almost a year after we had started the process for the seed round, is when we ended up getting that money in our bank account. And now we were like, okay, now we are probably past the valley of death, because $5 million at that point seemed like way too much money for 2 21-year-olds to be getting. And that meant that we could now definitely launch our demo satellites into space. We had a little bit more interest after we announced this. So quickly thereafter, we ended up adding about $2.3 million more to the seed round. So that became $7.3 million seed round, which is a fairly decent chunk of seed round for any company, right? So that's how that came together. So it was not a happy few months in between there. we still have no internet connection at our home. We've never had an internet connection. I've been always using the hotspots in the phone, and we still do that at home. So it was is really hard to be able to get into video calls and to be able to pitch
in Chikmagalur.
Like in Chikmagalur, yeah. But it happened. So
wow, that was that was near death, hey?
That was near death. I mean, if for some reason we wouldn't have gotten the money, Pixel wouldn't exist anymore.
Wow. And that's actually, I think, when I heard about you guys was in 2020 when you raised that $5 million round.
Yeah.
I think we had covered it in one of our news videos.
That's right.
Because at that point, right, space tech was still... It's crazy how things have changed so quickly from non-existent and it's just ISRO to now multiple players in this space.
Yeah.
And in 2022, you actually did launch proper... satellites into space to start collecting hyperspectral data.
That's right.
And was it like you just turned a switch and started generating revenue from that? Did you already have customers lined up, or did you have to start reaching out to people?
We had to start reaching out to people. No one paid us before we had satellites up in space. We had to actually beam data down from them, send some of it out for free, have them play around with it, and then ask them to pay us.
Give them a little taste.
Exactly.
The freemium model.
Exactly. Not even freemium. They just wanted to know that we were legit, that we actually had satellites and that these satellites were actually beaming down data. So for them to play around with it means that, this actually looks good. We'll pay for it. So in 2022, so February of 2021, we were supposed to launch Anand. And in, I think Feb 27th was when the launch was. Until Feb 15th, we were still thinking that this is going to go. I remember... for the last 3 days, for the final push, booked a flight and went to Chennai to make sure that it got done, because we were nowhere close to where we needed to be. This vendor that we were working with told us that they had tested for all of these things. And obviously, when someone more experienced than us tells us that they have done this, we obviously take it at face value. We shouldn't have, and we don't anymore. And then when our team was then doing the final series of tests to double verify, we realized that, holy shit, this hasn't actually been tested. This doesn't even work. And
the satellite wasn't working.
The satellite was, I mean, parts of it were working, but it wasn't working as a whole. Like, you would launch it, but then it would not turn on. And
just
it would
a chunk,
not,
chunk of expensive metal just, in space.
Yeah, exactly. The camera was working, but the satellite itself was not, right? And it was mainly the components that this provider had provided us, the onboard computer and how it sort of all worked together. And they were not transparent at all in telling us, you know, what was going wrong or how the code worked, because they thought we would steal their IP. And so in Feb, we are just trying to get it tested as quickly as possible. We had actually brought it the previous month and paid for testing at ISRO's testing facilities and all of that, and taken it back to Chennai for the final series of tests. And we realized that, holy shit, this component and the software that's written for it doesn't actually work in all the situations it needs to work. The ISRO folks were very helpful. So we had booked the launch with ISRO. I'd called up the chairman and said, hey, you know, we won't be able to send it to you today. And so they said, take a couple more days if you want, a couple more days of testing. And so they were very, you know, flexible that way. But a couple of days later, I told the chairman of New Space India Limited that, hey, sadly, we won't be able to launch. And they were very nice about it. They decided to launch the mass dummy and things like that. But of course, that night, I also got a call from the chairman of ISRO saying, hey, it's okay, ISRO also misses launches. We also miss, satellite deadlines, and this is the first time you're doing it. So that was very nice of them to be able to actually give us inspiration. But the team was very deflated at that point in time. So, you know, that evening, we decided we wouldn't launch. That night, I got the call from the chairman. The next day, flew down to Bangalore to be able to, you know, talk to the team and say, it's not happening right now, but it'll happen. But it was obviously people were not very happy.
That would have been
a big bummer.
Heartbreaking. Yeah.
Yeah. Big sure. bummer. Like we had booked buses for taking people to Sriharikota for the launch. We were asking people, you know, the t-shirt sizes for the launch size, and 15 days before the launch, you're like, oh, it's not happening. So it takes a big hit. The investors were spooked out and things like that. But what we did then, I think, you know, really helped the company. We decided the next month that, okay, this satellite, we need to retest it, and the next launch is happening in October of 2022. We really need to get a backup for the satellite in case, you know, this doesn't work, the component decides to give up at some point. And so we changed our strategy from building a commercial satellite at that point in time to building another demo satellite, just so that we had not all of our eggs in one basket. Took a lot of convincing with the investors and things like that, but I think that was the right call, because that demo satellite ended up going up before the first Anand satellite that we had working on. So I think all of that worked out in hindsight, but realizing that, things are difficult in space, and if you have the money, you need to have, you know, eggs in more than one basket. So it was very sad. Like, it was numb for me for the first week, because there were just so many things happening. But at the end of on the Sunday when the launch was supposed to happen, I wake up and I'm seeing the launch and I'm like, holy shit, we were supposed to be on there. It's not easy at that point in time, but you just have to get through it. Thankfully, I think all of that really ended up in a lot of ecstasy when we launched it next year, where it was a long 1 year.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you probably would have planned your financial runway around that launch because you would have known once we're in space, we can actually start to, you know, slow our burn a little bit with revenue from customers. Yeah. That plan completely changed. But were you guys in a good enough position financially to sort of, that it wasn't like another near-death experience, or did you have to change your strategy significantly?
Yeah, so the $5 million that had come in were tranched. So our investor said, we won't give you the entire money because you're students. We weren't students, but you know, you're young folks, so we want you to be financially prudent, which doesn't make sense because we were spending 90% of it on the satellites, not really on marketing. But anyway, what happened thankfully was the initial tranche of 3.25 out of the 5 million had come into the bank. That was not enough for us to start building another demo satellite. But thankfully, due to the interest of the new fund, which wanted to put in an additional $2 million, we said, hey, there's no way we're taking this money if you don't give in the second tranche. And so we had to, you know, maneuver all of that. And thankfully, the additional 1.5 came in and we were able to get two on top of that, which gave us enough to be able to say, now we can build a demo satellite, thankfully. So we were already spending money on the first Firefly satellite. And we had already put out orders and things like that. So we had to walk that back, cancel whatever we could. We lost money on some components because obviously they had started work on it. But we had enough to be able to sort of play around with at least a couple more demo satellites, and that worked out. But it was very tight, right? We had budgeted, as you said, we had budgeted for the runway to account for a few months after the launch. And if the launch gets delayed, then we are just continuing to spend on the salaries and operations, but the revenue is not coming in, which sort of helps with the runway. But later that year, we were able to also get a Series A round of funding thanks to the work that we had done and the hardware that we had actually built, which ended up easing it a whole lot more later that year in 2021. But early 2021, there are all these doubts. Will we have enough money to be able to actually build another? Will we have enough money after that launches to survive until we can start generating revenue and things like that?
Yeah. That Series A, that was it $25 million?
That's right. 27 yeah. to be exact.
27.
25 okay. is what we announced, and 2 million came in immediately thereafter. So 27 million Series A that we announced in early 2022. But we had the term sheet signed in late 2021, which gave us confidence that, we have a little bit more breathing room now.
Yeah, and avoiding situations where you have like one vendor being the single point of failure.
Yeah. Exactly. I vote after the seed round fiasco that we would never be in a position as a company where we can't pay our people. We've always planned our fundraisers and our satellite launches and our runways in such a way that if all things go wrong, we'll run out of money, but at never a point in time will we be at the mercy of an investment coming in.
Yeah, you guys have actually been extremely lucky to find that sweet spot between death and sort of things going too easily, right? Where you sort of skirted death, but those experiences sort of shape the DNA of the company going forward.
Yeah.
And you've been able to learn from those experiences.
Absolutely. Massive learning experiences. Yeah.
Yeah. So all of this, finally, this whole story that you've been telling me culminates with the launch of these, it's three satellites
three
at once, right?
Three different launches.
Oh, three different launches. Yeah. Okay. Were they back-to-back or they were spread
out? They were fairly back-to-back, yeah. The first one happened in April of 2022 when we launched Shakuntala. And that was, I think, that was when it all seemed a little real that, now we will be able to do something.
Now you're a business.
Now we're a business. And I think my parents also breathed a big sigh of relief at that point in time that, the satellite is finally up and it won't end up blowing up on our faces. They never obviously directly voiced these concerns, but, you can make out that people are worried about you, whether it's going to even, survive. Because it's not an easy job to launch a satellite. No one else in India had built and privately launched a satellite before that. So April 1st, 2022 is when we put it up, right? So not an April Fool's. The satellite was already integrated on the rocket. There was nothing that we could do now. All of the testing had been done. Shirij had gone to the US to see the launch in person. My passport was stuck at the visa office, so I couldn't go. And we had about four or five of our folks at the Kennedy Launch Center in Florida, where the launch was happening from. And the rest of us, all about 30, 35 folks, were at the office in Bangalore. The launch was happening at 10 p.m. in the night, India time. And, it was a nerve-wracking day because 3 days before the launch, they give out a probability of weather for launch. It started with about 75%, and then 2 days late, 2 days before the launch, it came down to 50, and a day before launch, it came down to 25%. And Florida was all sunny and great until then, but that was the day that something hurricane was starting or something. So, you know, not ideal timing. And I am just refreshing the weather every 20, 30 minutes since the morning to see what the weather would be like at 12 noon, which is the time that the rocket would go up. And it's showing me thunderstorms and it's showing me clear. It's showing me thunderstorms. It's showing me clear because it kept changing. At 4 p.m. India time, which was early morning there, there was a tornado warning in that area, right? And Chidi sent me a screenshot saying, oh, there's a tornado warning. I'm like, holy shit, is this going to happen? Not going to happen. We've invited all of our investors for a launch party, viewing party, and people have been waiting for this for ages. We have paid for the catering and everything else. And then it was the same thing that kept on happening until 2 hours before launch. And 2 hours before launch, the skies, you know, literally opened up. There was a video that was sent by the team that was in there where the sunlight, you could see the sunlight now. And then SpaceX announced that the launch is a go. So nerve-wracking. And then finally, the time came and all of us were there and we did the countdown together. And, you know, that was very emotional to be able to actually see the hardware you worked on for the past 3 years. I've been trying to put up there for the past 3 years is actually now going up, and then very surreal. And then that ecstasy lasted for, I think, 30 minutes, after which now the problem was, will we actually communicate with the satellite? Will the solar panels unfurl? Will the antenna unfurl? Will the satellite actually work? I was in the office making sure that we were on top of this until like 4 or 5 a.m. And then we finally got a message that the satellite has been... So our ground stations are all across the globe. We need to be touched with our partners to see if there has been a communication made. So we got that information at 4 a.m. in the morning, and then finally at 6 a.m. went back to sleep, woke up at 11, and then got more updates. The solar panels have been unfurled and antenna has been unfurled, and then it took a long process to get it to imaging. But I think once you... There are two stages to a space company, before space and after space, and it's let me tell you, it's much more easier being after space.
I'm sure, yeah. Now the focus is more on... I mean, you've already sort of validated the tech, right? It's just a matter of a copy and paste at that point, I'm guessing, maybe small iterations here and there.
Yeah.
But getting to the point where you can put these satellites up into space...
Yeah.
Does this still mean, I mean, you want to put up, what, is it 30 satellites in your full cluster?
24 to 30 satellites. I mean, the number depends on the exact demand, but at least 24 or maybe 30.
Okay. Is that going to require, you're going to keep raising funds from investors probably?
Or? Yeah, we have enough right now for the first batch of the 6 commercial satellites that we'll launch early next year. And that's all we need to get revenue started. And we can take the slow approach where we use the revenue from that to build more satellites.
Right, because your revenue could actually be, I mean... This is a lucrative business once you get going, right? some jobs or some clients might only be paying, you know, tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars, but there's actually work that you could do which would be in the millions.
Yeah, exactly.
So far, what kind of runs do you guys have? I don't know what you can talk about and what you can't talk about in terms of your customers, clients, but just give me broad strokes of what's the journey been like since revenue.
Yeah, so once we put these satellites up and we had images come down, it took about 3 to 4 months for us to get to a point where we had images down and we could correct them, and then we started sharing them with customers. And thankfully, there are a few sophisticated customers that understand the value of hyperspectral imaging. We didn't have to teach them a whole lot as to why they need hyperspectral. They've been doing their own research. And so we had to just go in and say, hey, we have satellites up in space. And they're like, oh, you have a hyperspectral satellite in space, because no one else does that. When you have something no one else does, it becomes easier to sell. So we reached out to a few companies in the mining space. For example, Rio Tinto is an early customer. We have been talking to a few oil and gas companies to see if we can detect oil and gas leaks. We're working with mining companies to help reduce the environmental impact of mining operations. A lot of agricultural companies that have the need for this data. And recently, the U.S. government has become a customer as well, they're using this data to evaluate how our data can help with a lot of different things for that country. And we're starting to work with the Indian government too. So I think that's really been helpful. Even though the contract amounts right now are not too huge, we are generating enough to pay back the satellites before the end of this year, right? All the 3 demo satellites that we have sent up to space, we would have recouped the cost that we have spent on that fairly soon, which is a good position to be. Now you can show that the unit economics work out. with just these three demo satellites, which are still not as good of a data that we will have, not as much as capacity that we will have, we're still able to, you know, break even. Shows that once we put these six satellites up there, we have more than 60 customers and, you know, many tens of millions of dollars in the revenue backlog that we can start realizing once we send these satellites up. So yeah, it's a long battle to putting something in space, and it's a long battle to raise money to put it up. But once you put it up, the margins are very high once you do that. So thankfully, we're in a position where we have proven technology. We've proven that customers are actually willing to pay a premium for this data. That was our thesis. And now it's just a matter of scaling that. The more data we have, the more it scales and the more the margins become.
Yeah. And also, it's interesting that you're making this much revenue. I mean, we don't know the amount, but or that's not
it's
information.
It's in the few millions.
In the
millions of dollars.
Wow. And at such an early stage where I'm guessing, yes, what you're able to show them is probably refined, maybe incorporating AI to clean up the image or process the image. But I don't think at this point still correct me if I'm wrong, but there might be sort of a more beautiful form factor, like sort of like almost like an app or a website where you could sort of scrub through the data with sliders and, you know, appification. Yeah. Have you guys reached that point yet?
Yeah.
Oh, you have?
We have done that since day one, right? So that's one of the approaches that we took differently from other satellite imaging companies. We realized that dumping data down and expecting customers to figure out how to work with it works for a few customers because there are a few sophisticated customers, but doesn't work if you're trying to build a business.
Here's a Google Drive link.
Exactly.
Good luck.
Yeah. So Google Drive also doesn't work in most cases. People use, until a few years ago, people still used hard drives to ship from one place to the other. But anyway, we're building this platform called the Aurora platform that we've been building for the past couple of years now. We were told that you're doing too many things at the same time, but we stuck through it because we realized that, it's not enough to just dump data. We need to provide the tools where people can come in and just as easily as you would be able to do on Google Earth or be able to do on Google Maps, you should be able to search for your image, draw a polygon, draw a square, and be able to, you know, see the images that have come down and be able to do things on top of those images, download that as reports, etc. So very recently, we just a couple of weeks ago put out the first of the forms for early adopters. So we've been working with a few customers to get feedback, and we are hosting a lot more, and it'll finally go full public early next year. But the Aurora platform enables anyone to not only visualize all of the data that we have downloaded, and it's especially important to visualize hyperspectral data because there's no platform that's specifically built for that, all the way to be able to generate a report for an ag company saying, generate for me the soil nutrient content report, or generate for me the yield report, or for an oil and gas company to generate a report for every time that there's a leak that has happened, for a mining company to see what deforestation that they have done before and after their operation. So that's the scale of the platform that we're building, and I thought it was important for us to start with that, lest we also fall into the same problem as other companies. And it's more important for us because not a lot of people know how to work with hyperspectral, whereas some people know how to work with other kinds of data.
You're doing B2B and B2G right now, or exploring relationships with government. Is there a plan at some point in the future to go a B2C route too, where an everyday person like me could maybe pay a subscription to gain access to
You can service? Do that starting early next year on the platform, right? If you want to pay for a single image of your home, you should be able to do that. We won't be able to make a business out of B2C, but an individual customer should be able to come in, and as you would search for something on Google Maps and change to Google Earth, you'll be able to place an order for an image or pay for something if you want to see what material your home is made of or something of that sort. People can just come in and do that. But we anticipate the business to be made B2B and B2G because that's where you sign multi-year, multi-million dollar contracts. But individual people can most definitely come in. There's a big thing going on about LLMs and ChatGPTs and chat-based interfaces.
I was
going to
ask you. That was my next question.
We are right now experimenting with it where next year, hopefully, you should be able to just type in and say, tell me the water quality content of different lakes in Bangalore, and all of the things happen in the background automatically, and it'll just spin out an answer instead of you having to figure out one after the other, or coming in and typing, tell me the number of cars that are parked in this Walmart lot on this day, and it'll be able to give you a number just through, you know, text-based interface.
The lakes of Bengaluru, that's going to be a viral Twitter thread, I'm sure.
Yeah.
It's incredible, actually, how you guys have positioned yourselves now. It's been a very difficult journey to get to this point, but now you sort of have like the keys to the kingdom in a way, right? I mean, you've secured this position of being, is it still the case that you're the only commercial provider of hyperspectral data in the form factor that you guys provided in?
Yeah. There were a couple of our competition that launched a couple of satellites just last month, but we don't know if the data is coming down from them yet. But As of now, we're the only one selling hyperspectral data commercially to anyone globally. We're also the only Indian company beaming down data and operating satellites today as well. So yeah, that's helpful. It's not going to last forever. I know there'll be other folks that'll come in, but I think the more we work on it, the more I think it is proven true that hyperspectral data was a need and that thesis was right.
Wow, amazing. I mean, this is something that I keep talking about that I really want to see, right? Because I've been looking at Indian startups since Jan of 2019. And I just want to see more companies like yours, where it's like an Indian company, an upstart, a couple of students, scrappy team, people tell them, no, it's not going to work. You can't do it. It's impossible. Yeah. You go ahead anyway. Yeah. And you're in hardware too, right? I mean, that's incredibly difficult. This isn't some SaaS play where you're targeting American clients. Yeah. That route, B2G, B2B, is much easier than what you guys have accomplished. But you're sort of a living proof that this is possible. And Indian companies can build for the world from India.
Absolutely. I think that's where the future needs to go. I'm an atoms more than bits person. So the last 3 decades have seen insane amounts of progress on the bit side of things, internet, AI, and everything else. Before that, it was a lot of atoms with regards to the silicon boom that happened. But I think it's time now for the world to move towards building more atoms, building more stuff, building more hardware, because you need something to go along with the software. We can't just go deeper and deeper into our screens and the internet. We need to go explore the universe that's out there, right? And that can only happen if you build.
That was Awais Ahmed, co-founder of Pixel. And by the way, he and his co-founder Kshitij actually knew each other in college because they used to play FIFA together. And it was over one of those gaming sessions that Awais actually pitched him the idea for Pixel. Thank you so much for watching or listening to the podcast this week, and I'll catch you in the next one.